And two of those can be two equivalent, and then two of those two equivalences can be two equivalents, and two of those can be equivalent, and then you have three levels. So the collection of two group words is a three group word, and then you sort of, at that point, a mathematician says, well, we should go to infinity.
Hi, welcome everybody. Our guest today is Mike Schulman from San Diego. He's known for his work on homotopy type theory and category theory and lots of other things. And more recently, higher observational type theory and the Naria proof assistant. I think he's played a major role in connecting sort of abstract ideas from homotopy theory with the practical and computational side of proof systems. So, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, if I may start asking you about your academic path, so to speak. In particular, one thing is interesting because you are a proper mathematician and then you care about foundation, right? And often people say, oh, no, this is divided. There's no such thing. How was your path to foundations and homotopy type theory?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I've kind of always been interested in foundations a little bit. I mean, when I was an undergraduate, I took logic courses and I did a summer project on logic and sort of as a sideline for a little while, I was really interested in non-standard analysis. And I have a whole bunch of those books on my shelf. And then I went to Cambridge for a year and took a category theory class from Eugenia Cheng and got sold on that. When I went to UChicago, I wanted to do category theory, and like Peter May was the only person there who I could conceivably work with. So I ended up being a topologist, and I learned a lot of topology. But I was always sort of interested in this foundational or logical direction, also. The way I got—I mean—and it was kind of a perfect setup, really, for me to be recruited by Steve Audy when homotopy type theory sort of burst on the scene, because I had this interest in logic and so on, but I also now had this background of homotopy theory that I'd developed and category theory. Homotopy type theory really grabbed me at the beginning because partly of my background in category theory, this sort of idea was in the air around that. This was back in the aughts. John Baez and people like that were making a big deal about of doing things up to isomorphism or up to equivalence all the time in weak higher categories. Homotopy type theory sort of had this promise of making everything isomorphism invariant or homotopy invariant, that we could have foundation based on higher categories or higher group weights. Steve's students and some other people like Michael Warren and Peter Lumsdaine had been proving various things in that direction. And then Steve invited me to come to this talk by Vygotsky, and then things sort of snowballed from there, I guess.
So you were recruited by Steve. I didn't actually know this. Did you work in CMU or?
No, I was never at CMU myself. I was a grad student and a postdoc at UChicago, which is, I guess to a European, they're not very close, but to an American, they're very pretty close together. Yeah. They were close enough that at that meeting where we all came to hear Vygotsky talk about univalence for the first time, there was this big snowstorm that shut down all the airplanes. I was able to rent a car and drive back to Chicago in a day. So that's pretty close.
Maybe can I follow up a little bit on that.
Yeah.
For our audience, we had Steve already here as a guest, but still, would you be so kind of give us a rundown? What is HOT? So what is homotopy type theory for those?
Yeah, absolutely. Type theory, I expect your listeners have heard Thorsten ramble on about type theory a bunch. Type theory is sort of a theory that could be foundational, like set theory, but where the basic objects are types, which are distinguished from sets, among other things, by not overlapping, basically, that every element comes with a type rather than it being a question that you can ask. Thorsten will interrupt me if I say something he hates.
No, that's all right.
The homotopy type theory, the idea is that instead of treating types like sets, we can treat types as some homotopical or categorical object that are some variously called spaces, homotopy spaces, infinity groupoids, anima, various things of this sort, where in addition to elements, one of these things has paths or homotopies or equivalences or isomorphisms or identifications, whatever we call them, reasons why two of them are the two points are the same, and two points could be the same in more than one way if they are the same, and then that gives a higher dimensional structure because you can iterate it. Two paths can be the same or not the same, and two of those can be the same or not the same, and so on. And so this sort of structure has been studied by homotopy theorists and category theorists in various different ways and under various different names for decades. But the idea of homotopy type theory is now that rather than defining these things in terms of sets, we take them as sort of the basic objects of study in mathematics. And so there have been sort of a bunch of different, several different sort of waves maybe, or homotopy type theory. And I expect we'll get into that a little bit later. Innovations of Steve Novotsky was the first beginnings of that idea. I would figure out how to make it work.
So why would somebody who doesn't, who's maybe not mainly interested in topology or algebraic topology, why would they care about hot?
That's a good question.
Should they? Maybe they shouldn't.
Yeah, so I always like to start with that, right? I mean, it's I don't want to oversell it, right? For somebody who's for a combinatorialist or an analyst, somebody who is interested in simple structures that are built out of sets that don't have a lot of higher structure to them, it's maybe not that important. It's a refinement. It's not a revolution. You might say. Where it starts to have benefits is when you start talking about structural mathematics and you're studying not just numbers but groups or rings or vector spaces or some kind of a structure which is built out of sets and or types and operations on them. And then you start comparing various of these, and very quickly you run into this observation that different structures are essentially the same. Like there's really only one group with two elements. Any two of them are isomorphic in exactly one way. And so group theorists start quite quickly talking about the group with two elements, but sort of from a classical set theoretic or even a non-homotopy type theory perspective, there are actually lots of different groups with two elements, and they're all just isomorphic. And so the nice thing about homotopy type theory is that with univalence, you can say that these groups are actually equal in the sense of that, in the only sense that that makes any sense. the only notion of equality that applies to them is the one that says that they're equal. And so mathematicians sort of informally say, okay, well, anything we can say about a group with two elements is true about any other group with two elements, but that's not literally true in sort of a set theoretic framework. But now it becomes literally true. We have a way to automatically translate from something about one to another one. And that's maybe not all that important for pencil and paper mathematics. When you start working with groups, but when you start formalizing things in a computer, then it can be helpful to have this automated way to translate, so you don't have to manually code up what it means to transfer commutativity across an isomorphism every time you come up with a new property of groups. Also, it's been observed many times that I think different fields of mathematics, over time, they start to get more categorified and homotopified when you start looking at structures. And then eventually you're studying so many different structures that you start studying structures of structures. And then eventually you're in this world where you have to deal with all sorts of homotopical or higher categorical information. So the nice thing about homotopy type theory is that all this information is there in the background automatically, and it appears whenever you need it without you having to do anything to put it in. As soon as you start talking about structures, you automatically have the right notion of sameness between them. And as soon as you start talking about structures of structures, you automatically have the right notion of sameness between them, and so on.
So do you think that using a hot changes the way you think about mathematics?
Yes. I don't I don't know how big of a change it is. It depends on how much of an impact it has on you. I mean, for the average mathematician, right, doesn't really care whether sets are ZF sets or types of H level zero or whatever they are. And so from that perspective, right, a mathematician who's thinking like that and sort of wasn't really trained in logic, it's not going to maybe make a huge difference to how they think about things. But I guess I think it does sort of train you to think more in the structural way, I guess, thinking of sets as being defined not by collecting some pre-existing elements, but like as, as a structure. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm not the best person to answer that because sort of I already thought like that. So it didn't really change the way I thought.
Yeah, but for somebody else, maybe it could be some education to approach.
And you mentioned like there are different waves of HOT or of these foundations. Would you be so kind and help us? What was like the OG version? What is the newest one? Is maybe yours, but maybe some steps in between.
Sure. So there's sort of three general approaches maybe now to making this formal system work. There's the original one that came from Steve's and Vavadsky's and Michael and Peter and all those people and building on the special year and so on, and goes into the book called Homotopy Type Theory, which we call the book or the hot book. And so that version of the theory is sometimes called book hot, because it came from the one that we used in the book. And then the next one that sort of came after that is called cubicle type theory. And there are a lot of different kinds of cubicle type theories. And then the more recent one that is not fully realized yet, but Thorsten and Amrush and I and our students are working on, called higher observational type theory. Recently I've been thinking that when we talk about the differences between these three ways of doing HOT, we are emphasizing the wrong thing. We often talk about it as being the differences being about like the definition of identity types. That in book HOT, the identity types are the smallest reflexive relation, or they're inductively generated by reflexivity. And then in cubicle type theory, they're defined by paths mapping out of an interval of some kind. And then in higher observational type theory, they're defined sort of observationally based on what the type is that we're looking at. And that's important. But I'm starting to think that it's almost downstream of a more fundamental difference, which is the way that we deal with infinity. Which is sort of a grandiose thing to say, but in a way, it's kind of like what all of mathematics is about, is sort of dealing with infinity. In the book hot, I mean, I don't know, maybe I should back up a little bit. So the problem with trying to formulate a foundational theory in which the basic objects are infinity groupoids is that an infinity groupoid has infinity in it. It sort of has an infinite tower of structure, and sort of how do you describe all of that structure? And
say a little bit more for the audience what an infinity groupoid is intuitively?
Yeah. I guess I mentioned it really briefly before, but an example of an ordinary groupoid is a collection of sets. Right? So you have sets, and then you have isomorphisms between sets or bijections between sets. And we structurally consider two sets to be the same if they are related by a bijection, because we can transfer the structure of a group across a bijection or anything like whatever thing we want to do with it structurally. And similarly, like collection of groups and group isomorphisms or the collection of topological spaces and homeomorphisms or whatever forms a groupoid. The collection of isomorphisms between two groups is just a set. If I ask whether two isomorphisms are the same, they are the same or they're not the same. But if you talk about the collection of categories or the collection of groupoids themselves, then when are two categories the same? Two categories are the same when they're equivalent, meaning there's a functor between them going back the other way, but the composites are just naturally isomorphic to the identities. And then, if I ask about the collection of equivalences between two categories, that's a groupoid itself, because two equivalences could be isomorphic and maybe in more than one way. And so I have two different levels of notions of sameness. And that forms what's called a two-groupoid, where I have objects and then I have equivalences or isomorphisms between them, and then I have another layer of isomorphism between those. And then you can say, well, what about the collection of two groupoids? And two of those can be two equivalent, and then two of those two equivalences can be two equivalents, and two of those can be equivalent, and then you have three levels. So the collection of two groupoids is a three groupoid. And then you sort of, at that point, a mathematician says, well, we should go to infinity. And so an infinity groupoid, it has points and then equivalences between them, and equivalences between those, and equivalences between those, and equivalences between those, and so on all the way up.
Just one thing. I noticed that you start with zero, and I would start with minus one.
Yes. Well, yes. So I started with zero because sort of that's the historical way of thinking about it. And then you sort of go downwards from zero also, which John Baez called negative thinking. In type theory, we have sort of a stratification of the types, that types represent infinity groupoids, and then we can identify which of them act like two groupoids or one groupoids or zero groupoids, which are like sets. And then the level below that is the minus one groupoids, which are basically either, well, from the classical perspective, they're either empty or trivial. From a constructive perspective, you could say something like, if they have a point, then they're trivial.
But what I wanted to refer to is that the structure is the structure of an equivalence relation, right? I mean, so in a way, to explain higher groupoids to people with maybe in computer science, they have no equivalence relations, and then I say, okay, groupoid is equivalence relation on steroids.
That's a good point, definitely. So if instead of starting from sets, you start from equivalence relations, which sort of from a univalent perspective, there's maybe no difference between that. But if you think about like a collection of presentations of elements of a set, and you have some equivalences between them, then passing to a groupoid is basically just saying like, you can have more than one sort of witness or reason why two things are equivalent. But the thing that makes it complicated is that once you have these just extra structure and you really want to study that extra structure, then you need coherence conditions on it. You need to be able to say if A is equivalent to B is equivalent to C is equivalent to D, then the two different ways of making that A equivalent to D are actually equivalent. And then that sort of puts you in this world where we have infinitely many coherence structures and conditions that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, but you were, I interrupted you, but you
That's
were
okay.
making an interesting, yeah. interesting point about these different views about infinity.
The question is sort of how you deal with all this infinite much structure in a formal system, which, I mean, to a formal system to be usable by a human or implementable in a computer, it has to be somehow finitely coded.
Mm-hmm.
People misunderstand what Vygotsky really brought to the subject. It's just sort of people talk about Vygotsky contributing univalence as sort of like this big thing that made the subject work. But really univalence was obvious. Pre-Vygotsky, we knew that something like univalence would be true if we had a theory that would work. What Vygotsky did was he came up with a definition that made it possible to state univalence.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of univalence was already there in this Hoffman-Striker groupoid model paper. They call it universe extensionality. Univalence, by the way, I should probably say this, right? So in type theory, we have, among all the types, we have types which are called universe types whose elements are other types. Not all of them for like paradoxical reasons, but a collection of small types form a universe. And so we can talk about when two types are equal. And univalence is a principle that says two types are equal when they're equivalent, which is really just incarnating the idea that I was describing before, that two sets are equal or equivalent or the same when they're isomorphic, and two groupoids are the same when they're equivalent, and so on. So in a sense, that's obvious, really, to a category theorist or a homotopy theorist. But the problem was that we didn't know how to say equivalent in type theory before Vygotsky came along, because a priori, it seems like it requires infinitely much data to sort of somehow encode it. And Vygotsky came up with this really clever way of saying what it means for two types to be equivalent using finitely much data. And I remember after at that weekend in CMU, we all came and heard Vygotsky talk. And afterwards in the pub, we were all sitting around and we weren't talking about univalence. We were talking about his definition of equivalence, because that was the really exciting thing. And relating it to other ideas of equivalence that people had thought about and we were more familiar in homotopy theory and stuff like that. So in a sense, that the idea of that first wave was to use finite definitions to produce all the higher structure in some sort of automatic way. And like the paradigm of that maybe is to say, like, when we say that a type is contractible, that Vygotsky's innovation was to say that a type is contractible in sort of the homotopical sense of having no higher information at any dimension. All you have to say is that there's a point and everything else is equal to that point.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like the very naive set theoretic way of saying that it's a one element set or a one element type. And Vygotsky realized that if you write that definition directly and naively in the type theory, it actually tells you not just that any two points are equal, but also any two paths are equal and any two paths between paths are equal, and sort of all this higher stuff disappears.
Here that was a point where some of type theory was essential, but I think Vygotsky learned type theory because he wanted to formalize some results, but then he realized that this is actually more than just a vehicle, but it's also maybe a way to express these ideas. Right?
Yeah, I wouldn't claim that I really know exactly what sort of path Vygotsky went through, but I've definitely heard. Yeah. All right, that was where he came from.
By the way, there are lots of equivalent definition of equivalence.
Yes.
Which one is your favorite?
My favorite is the one, the higher co-inductive one that we use in homotopy.
Yes. Okay.
We can get to that later.
Yeah. Okay, but this is an infinite one, right? So in a way, you are overcoming Vygotsky's idea, which initially sort of excited you, right?
To have
finitary different,
Yeah.
Can you quickly say what is the notion of equivalence you learned from Vygotsky? Is it the fibers are contractible
That was Vygotsky's first version, was to say that a map is an equivalence if its fibers are contractible, or sort of in the set theoretic phrasing, to say that the preimage of every point is a singleton. And that turns out to be tell you automatically that it has all the higher sort of coherent notions. And then afterwards, people came up with various other versions too.
Yeah. I always think it's interesting to contrast this with the notion of bijection, where you say basically what you just said, right? With a unique existence. But then in type theory, you use the notion of contractibility, which also applies to the equality, actually, the equality proof, right? Uh-huh. So that's the sort of trick which makes it grow ad infinitum, right?
Yes, yeah, you can definitely say that. But one of the things I don't like about Vygotsky's definition is that it's not symmetric.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
It's sort of, you have a map in one direction, and then you say that its fibers are contractible, and you can use that to make an equivalence in the other direction, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
And very few of these definitions are symmetrical.
I don't want to interrupt the flow between, maybe you want to talk about cubical times already, but the very naive question, as somebody with hardly any topology or algebraic geometry background, how symmetrical is the fruitfulness between the fields of type theory and homotopy theory? Is it like really that you can get new topologically interesting work out of it? Is it working that way as well? Or is it mostly we now used homotopy theory and we enrich type theory and logic and foundation, but look, so to speak, for somebody only interested in topology, nothing really new happens but one weird application?
Yeah, that's a great question. so far, I would say the direct influence on homotopy theory and higher category theory has been limited, but not empty. Certainly a lot of it is the flowing from homotopy theory to type theory and importing these ideas into type theory. Part of that is just because the homotopy theorists have such a big head start. They've been doing this for decades, and we're sort of just trying to catch up and do the basic things that they can do. And part of it is because there's so many more of them. And so it's hard for us to catch up because there isn't that many of us working. Also part of it is we're sort of wearing the hair shirt. We're doing things in a way that is more difficult in some ways because we get more out of it. Thorsten, you like to make this point about constructive mathematics somehow, right? You can avoid axioms and you get a more general theory. We're working in an axiomatic or a formal system, and that sort of limits what we can do. It forces us to be invariant, homotopy invariant or isomorphism invariant, and that gives us better results because, among other things, right, it means that sort of that the theorems that we prove are interpretable in any model of this theory. But it also, in some sense, it takes away some things that classical mathematicians can do that allows them to get to things quicker. So I would say like the influence that's gone the other way has been partly in the direction of inspiration and ideas. Learning to think type theoretically or homotopy type theoretically, and then using ideas from that to inspire work that's phrased in a more traditional context, which is sort of better or cleaner than it would have been otherwise, but it's not literally phrased using the type theory. Then there have been some places like the most famous of these applications is the Blakers-Massey theorem in higher topoi, which there wasn't a native proof of that used in higher topos before we had the proof in type theory, and then that type theoretic proof was later translated back into classical category theoretic language.
I think
over time there will be more of these sort of applications, but it feels like it's going to be an uphill battle for a long time because so many mathematicians are not really foundationally interested somehow. Right? Like they just care about using some tool. Jacob Lurie wrote this giant tome, and they can say, okay, Lurie did this and this and this and this and this, and then I'm going to do it this way. And it doesn't really matter to them that there's a cleaner or more elegant or more general way of doing it using the type theory.
So just one remark. I mean, we had Emily Riehl recently, right? And she talked about synthetic mathematics and that certain things, are almost sort of very hard to write down in the classical framework because you have too many conditions to check. But if you do them in type theory, look, you can do them synthetically. So in a way, you avoid lots of boilerplate, right? I mean, I had a colleague. I mean, he now moved on. I mean, he moved to a different place, he was interested in mathematical physics, and he used actually higher categories to do this. And he was always complaining about he had to check lots of conditions. And basically, in the end, they just said, "Oh yeah, we know it's true. We're not going to check this," you know. So I always try to convince him to do this sort of more synthetically in type theory, and that seems to be a sort of application, right? Or what you think about this?
Yeah, and that's the sort of, in a way, that's kind of the problem, really, is that mathematicians want to do stuff. Every mathematician has sort of a boundary within which they're willing to do work. right? Mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. sort of when, sure. when they get to something that's outside that boundary, they're not interested in it. And what they really want is for somebody else to give them a tool to do their yeah. work. But when they're yeah. inside that boundary, then they want to do the work, and maybe they get disappointed if somebody else does it for them. Mm-hmm. Or at least that's sort of what I observe.
Good description.
and for a lot of people, this sort of category theoretic, homotopy theoretic thing is outside their little bubble of interest. And so mm-hmm. They want to be able to say, by higher topos theory 6.2.4.8, poof. And if they can't find higher topos theory 6.2.4.8, they just say, well, clearly it's in there somewhere. And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. But the people who go in later and sort of try to figure out whether it's there or not and prove it if it isn't there, that means somehow it's not as appreciated maybe. And the people who come in like us and say, well, actually, there's a better way to do it where you don't even need to worry about whether it's there or not, because you can just... it's the sort of thing where you can really just check it yourself, or if you do this synthetically, then you don't have to do this. I mean, we come along and say that, and people say, okay, but I already did it. I used 6.2.4.8, and that was good enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we now maybe talk about one particular tool? And now I'm switching gears and turning Thorsten into a guest maybe as well, because you both are in that. So let's bracket cubicle types for now. We will have cubicle type theory. What is it? Cubicle type theory or cubicle hot? I'm slightly confused.
Cubicle type theory.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
it's an implementation of hot, so in a way, I would say. I mean, mm-hmm. Mike made this nice sort of history, right? We first book hot, then cubicle, and now HOTT. And you maybe wanted to say a bit more about this.
I don't want to say much about cubicle type theory, but to skip over it, maybe.
Yeah.
Because what I was going to say about how the way we deal with infinity is that in Bookhart, we sort of write finite definitions like contractibility or Wawelski equivalence or whatever, and they sort of generate all the higher structure. Or even the Martin Luft definition of the identity type is like that. It's sort of a finite definition that generates all higher structure, and I really love that about it. That especially that last bit that sort of Martin Luft wrote down this definition of the identity type, because he wasn't thinking about homotopy theory.
Mm.
He was just thinking about what equality means, and somehow higher topos theory, higher category theory, and infinity groupoids are implicit in the notion of equality. And that was one of the things that I loved most about it.
I shouldn't interrupt you all the time. It's been gone. So.
No, go ahead. I think.
I was just thinking, we discussed this already with Steve. So the question whether, so Martin Luft didn't formulate this uniqueness of equality proofs or this principle K or axiom K, right? And we say this was maybe more or less an accident. I mean, as you just said, he wanted to formulate equality. And I think he had this sort of one-point equality in his mind, which would be J and K. And for whatever reason, he never included K, right? Which Thomas Streicher observed much later. So do you agree that this is maybe more a historical accident, or was Martin Luft so clairvoyant that he could see these consequences? Or?
Well, I don't know. I'm not inside Martin Luft's head.
I know. Speculation.
but I mean, there's in a way, it was certainly an accident. I think I certainly agree, as far as I know, that he never intended anything like a homotopy interpretation. I don't think I've ever read anything that he wrote that suggested that he was considering or aware of the possibility of having multiple proofs of identity. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I would say that it's completely an accident that he never wrote down K, because if you sort of take a very abstract, or I don't know if it's actually like a principled viewpoint, which I think uh-huh. he certainly does, uh-huh. then K is unnatural.
Yeah.
If you think about the identity types as generated by reflexivity, and you can write that right in modern type theories, you can write them as a special case of an indexed inductive family.
Yes.
Then the eliminator you get is J. You don't get K.
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, more syntactic. It may just have been being principled.
Yeah, it's more sort of syntactic, the structure of the definition, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's what I really liked about it, is that you get all this higher structure from just the simple definition. But it has various problems. Like, for instance, one thing, there's a lot of higher things you'd like to be able to do that you can't access, really. Like you, as far as we know, you can't define a simplicial type coherently and talk about higher infinity one categories defined in terms of infinity groupoids. And also, it's so the univalence is not computational. This was the really big push towards other cubical type theory. You can't write it, treat it as a programming language. Your execution gets stuck on univalence when you write it as an axiom. And so cubical type theory solved that last problem by destroying the thing that I loved about Bookhot and sort of going back to the classical mathematician's way of doing things and sort of just putting in all the higher definitions by hand, saying like, this is your one-dimensional composition, this is your two-dimensional composition, this is your three-dimensional composition, blah, 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 blah. And that sort of worked to make it computational, but I never liked it because it's not what I wanted about the theory. And those are sort of the two obvious ways of dealing with infinity, is sort of to have some finite thing that generates it, and then to have some explicit definition of all of it. But I would argue that in higher observational type theory, we found a third way of doing it, which is to take a co-inductive perspective on infinity, which is somehow sort of in between these two extremes. And it allows us to write a simple finite definition which nevertheless actually includes all the higher stuff and allows us to compute with it, unlike the Bookhot version. If we're going to go on with this, we should probably say to the listeners what co-inductive means. But
yes, that's a good idea. Yeah. Yeah, what's co-induction?
Yes.
Mike.
So the average mathematician is maybe familiar with induction, at least induction on the natural numbers. So something that's inductively defined is sort of generated from nothing by applying operations. So the natural numbers are generated by starting by zero and by the successor operation. And when you're programming, you write down a definition of an algebraic data type or something like that, and then an element of that data type is at least in a strict language like ML, is a finite structure that's built out of putting together these constructor operations, a list or a tree or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then when you have an inductive structure, you can sort of traverse it and sort of do things over it reductively and recursively. A co-inductive structure or definition is the opposite, where something is defined not by how it's built up, but by what you can do with it. So the classical example of a co-inductive definition, which is almost too simple to really give the idea of, it is an infinite list or an infinite stream, where you say a stream of, say, natural numbers is defined by saying, well, every stream you can pull off the first element, which is a natural number, and then you can take the rest of it, which is another stream, and then if you would do that successively, you can pull off as many natural numbers as you want, and there's an infinite supply of them. But you never have to actually deal with a completed infinity in some sense. And from a programming perspective, one way to think about a co-inductive structure is that it's kind of a lazy data structure. So it's like a Haskell programmer. A list in Haskell is potentially an infinite stream where you can pull off elements that are sort of being generated lazily as you want them. I think it's a little bit better to think of a co-inductive structure as more like an object in an object-oriented programming language, but it's sort of an immutable object, maybe. You can call different methods on it, which are basically like things you can do with it, and maybe some of those methods will produce a changed version of that object, like pulling off taking the tail of a stream. The rest of the stream produces another stream, and that sort of it changes in some sense as you apply these methods to it. But the potential behaviors of an object are infinite, whereas the data contained in an algebraic data type is finite.
Yeah, for my class, I always show them the co-natural numbers, which the predecessor
even simpler than the string.
Yeah, no, a bit more exotic, but it's quite fun, I think. So I say, okay, first of all, you know the predecessor operation on natural numbers, which either returns an error or if it's zero, or for any other number, the predecessor. And then I say, okay, and a co-natural number is something for which you have a predecessor operation. And then you start, and then you can define. It's actually quite fun to define the arithmetical operations in the mirror image. It's actually not so completely easy. It was quite fun. And I set them, I give some definition of addition, and then I say, now define multiplication, which is actually a bit of a puzzle.
That sounds like a fun exercise. So for the listeners, right, what is a co-natural number, right? It turns out that it's either an ordinary natural number or it's infinity, at least classically speaking. which is infinity is the co-natural number with its own predecessor. Constructively,
but then it's also interesting, maybe to mention the equality of these infinite objects. I mean, it's interesting, and then you get the principle, which is actually called co-induction, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People call it that. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't really like calling that co-induction because it seems like a very impoverished thing to give the overall name of co-induction. I usually call that like the bisimulation or something like. But yeah, so co-inductive objects are equal when they have all the same behaviors co-inductively.
Exactly.
So two infinite lists are equal if their first elements are equal and their tails are equal as infinite lists. And so basically that means you can write a program which will sort of traverse the list and is guaranteed to check that these two elements are equal, and then the next two elements are equal, and so on and so forth.
So then in particular, does this make sense?
Any two co-natural numbers that are their own predecessors are equal.
Dennis, maybe you can ask some question if it's because you are the...
I think this part of co-induction is fine, but at some point I would like to talk about the computer usage as a tool. And particularly on one aspect there, whether it's good to black box it, so whether this is something we need to produce as ready to use to mathematicians, or whether this is an impossible dream that we always need to open up, so to speak, the program to fully understand what's there when we formalize it. But if that's too much of a jump, we don't need to do it now, we can do it in 5 minutes.
Yeah, because I interrupted Mike, and I think you were just trying to explain what this notion of infinity and co-induction, how does this apply to the equality to this group? Mm-hmm. Maybe you can continue a bit, and then we go maybe to this question. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I say that in higher observational type theory we treat sort of this infinity groupoid structure co-inductively, then in a way, it's a very natural way to think about a higher groupoid or higher category, because what is it? We say every space or every infinity groupoid, for any two elements, we have a notion of when they're equal, and that notion, that collection of isomorphisms, is another space. So it's very natural to say, but that's a definition of an infinity groupoid, is that it's a thing that has a bunch of points, and then between any two of them, we have another space, another infinity groupoid of ways in which they're equal. And that isn't a sufficient definition because you have to give the higher operations and coherence, but it's sort of the first step towards seeing why this is co-induction is a very natural way to approach this question. And in one of the things that we've done in higher observational type theory is to come up with a way to express co-inductively all of this higher structure. And it basically comes down to a definition of equivalence, really, which was mentioned earlier, this co-inductive notion of equivalence of types. Basically, we say we define the universe of types by saying, right, it says elements are types, and then to say when these things are equal, we say that they're equivalent. And this notion of equivalence sort of co-inductively says that two types are equivalent if there is a relation between them, which is a one-to-one correspondence or a bijection, but not as a function, as a relation, right? So there's a relation, and then everything in A, there's something that's in B that's related to it, and everything in B, there's something in A that's related to it. And then co-inductively, we say that the witnesses of relatedness are also a type. And so that that generates all the higher structure because it tells us. So it's a little bit technical how it ends up happening, but these related this relation is sort of dependent on points in A and B, and so whenever I have equalities in A and B, I get equalities between these relations that can be sort of translated, and they get this sort of cubical box filling. And then, if you just think about a type being related to itself, then this is auto equivalence, that self equivalence from something to itself. You say, well, that's its identity types, and then this sort of transport or whatever automatically becomes composition and symmetry and all the higher operations of the group wide. So by saying what an equivalence is, basically we say two types are equivalent if there's a correspondence between them and also a correspondence between their identity types. Yeah, also an equivalence between their identity types. And that's sort of that co-inductive thing that gets it started. We have an equivalence here, which is sort of points map back and forth. And then we have an equivalence at the next level, which then tells us that equalities map back and forth. And then an equivalence at the next level, just like a stream, we have a consequence of things. Now we have a sequence of sort of bijections. And that encapsulates an infinite amount of data, but in this finite notion of this co-induction. And it allows us to compute with it because all the infinite stuff is there, but it still sort of comes out naturally. So it still makes me happy to say now I understand like all this higher structure comes out from finite understandings of what it means for two things to be equivalent, basically. It's a little bit difficult to, I mean, it gets a little bit technical. So I
think maybe, maybe a point here is that the equality of functions is a function, the quality of inductive types, so that there is a certain co-inductive repetition, which is also important.
That sort of gets into even going back to what I was saying earlier, that we define a type by saying we have points, and then between the two points we have a type of equalities. And so when you define something in a co-inductive type, you sort of say, well, like it's a, I have to give it and all of its sort of tails at the same time, all of its other behaviors in some single notion. And so if I'm defining, say, inductive types, I give all their identity types also, and those are also instances of inductive types. If I'm defining function types, I give their identity types also, and those are also instances of function types.
Good. Dennis says to come back to your question that we don't...
Yeah, okay, then let's now focus on how to turn this, I mean, something that this whole hot movement had going forward is like the nice computational properties, and that there were theorem provers developed for it with it. And this also happens for your approach, right? Would you two mind telling a little bit about that work? How is it going? How much math have we formalized already? Not yet.
Yeah. May I add a question to Mike especially? Because, I mean, Mike is a mathematician, right? And I'm quite impressed that he is sitting down and hacking in a proof system. How did you end up doing this, you know?
How did I end up creating my own proof assistant?
Well,
nobody else would make the one I wanted.
Yeah.
Mean, I've always been a bit of a programmer on the side. I did some started programming in high school, and when I was in college, I considered double majoring in computer science, but I decided to stop because I wanted to take more math classes. But I was a volunteer sysadmin for when I was in grad school for a summer program, and I continued sort of being connected to computer stuff. So when I got interested in category theory, I started learning about monads and Haskell and ML and things like this. And so it's not completely out of the blue that I sat down without having programmed before and started to write a proof assistant. Sure. I've also had a lot of help from other people in the type theory, homotopy type theory community. I learned a huge amount from Dan Licata about how the design of type theories and sort of moving towards implementation, and also from people like John Sterling and Favonia and other people that I'm certainly going to forget to mention. Helped give me a whole lot of help in sort of building an understanding of the way things are implemented. But I really wanted a proof assistant that would implement high observational type theory and sort of for the last decade or more, right, when you want something new implemented in type theory, the thing that you do is you go ask the AGDA developers to implement it in AGDA.
Yeah.
But the AGDA developers didn't seem interested in implementing hierarchical type theory. Some people have asked me, well, why didn't you go implement it in AGDA? First of all, one answer is that I don't really like AGDA. It's great for many things. It's really innovative, and it can do a whole lot of amazing things. And I have used it myself and been very happy with what it can do. But as a proof assistant, there are things that I want that it doesn't have. I really like tactics and sort of the progressive evaluation like we have in ROC. There are other sort of warts that annoy me about it. Also, I think it would have taken me even more time to understand the internals of AGDA well enough to implement everything in it than it would have been to actually just sit down and write a new one from scratch. And also with more fun. I feel Narya, the new proof assistant that I've been writing for high observational type theory, when I code in it, I feel like a kid in a candy shop, except that I got to build the candy shop. I've always wanted a proof assistant that does this, and now sort of like, I actually have one, and I actually even made it. It's been a lot of fun, really. I only wish I had more time to spend on it.
And where is it standing right now?
Is it
like a prototype showing that this idea works?
It doesn't quite show that high observational type theory works because we haven't quite yet. We haven't quite figured out how to prove that the universe is vibrant, how to compute compositions and operations in the universe in the way they can be implemented. But we have some good ideas, and we're working on it, and I have some hope that we'll be there soon. But it's already a working proof assistant. It's not as convenient to use as sort of the really industrial ones like ROC and AGDA and Lean, because it doesn't have implicit arguments and unification and things like that yet. So you have to fill in all the arguments by hand. But it is a full-featured type theory, and it works, and you can use it. And a lot of higher observational type theory is already implemented. And so we have sort of experimented with it and done some basic homotopy theoretic stuff. And we've checked, for instance, that we do have univalence, and univalence computes in a way which it doesn't compute even in cubical type theory. It can compute a little more strictly even than in cubical type theory. I find it a pretty convincing proof of concept, we're working towards making it more usable.
I think we're going to put a link in that people who want to play with it. But I think, there's a very nice documentation, some web pages. So the one thing which I find really, which is really interesting is that you, at the same time, you define not just constructors or elements of the type, but also of the equality and equality of equality. This is already implemented, and this I find quite beautiful. Right? If you say, successor creates the natural numbers, but it turns out successor also creates the equality proofs of natural numbers, and so on. So that this is already the sort of co-inductive nature, or this co-inductive explanation is already very natively built into Narya, which I think is very beautiful. And there are these surprising things, a bit like that the proof of reflexivity of types turned out to be equality itself. So there are lots of strange loops which are really fascinating to observe. So I really recommend to read this documentation and play around with Narya, despite all this, that it's not completely finished. Yeah.
So there's some back and forth. You learn something about the theory as well by observing, for instance, that? Or would you say this is just a tiny stone that's curious but has no systematic value for developing the theory? That didn't make sense for you?
I've definitely learned a lot by doing the implementation. I think we're making progress towards, like, say, a normalization proof or actually proving that the theory is computational, and I never would have gotten there without actually trying to implement it and having something that actually computes what we have to do to make that work.
And if we think 7 years into the future and one huge grant from whatever, the ERC, the MURI, or whatever, which kind, is there a kind of math that will work likely better here? Is it taking?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think we have to experiment and see what kind of a difference it makes. I feel like cubicle type theory hasn't completely lived up to its promise. Until recently, I would have felt a little bit uncomfortable saying that publicly. But I think even some people that are maybe more authoritative than me, like John Sterling, have been sort of unhappy with it, partly or because it's sort of very difficult to implement unification and in a cubicle proof assistant, and you get all these sort of weird boundary conditions that you have to deal with. And also, I think partly because univalence doesn't compute as nicely as you would like it to. Right? In cubicle type theory, computes and it has univalence, but it sort of has univalence because you put it in with an axiom that they call a glue type, and they just figured out a way to make that axiom compute. But in Harb's rational type theory, I think we can argue that univalence is really true by definition. That for a suitable definition of equivalence, equality of types really is equivalence by definition. Maybe that's a sort of a circular thing to say, but I have some hopes that it will make working with structures more convenient, that we can actually use equality of types as our definition of, as our notion of equivalence, as our notion of isomorphism. I would really like to have that be the case and not have to actually pass back and forth between equivalences and equalities of types the way we do when we formalize in Bokhod and even in cubicle type theory. So, in terms of what kinds of math that will actually make possible or easier, I don't know. Again, going back to what we said before, at the average mathematician, maybe this doesn't make much of a difference. But I would really like to see what doing synthetic homotopy theory is like in a theory like this, whether it makes some things easier or harder. I'd like to see how the efficiency of computation compares to cubicle type theory. Narya is not at all tuned to compute efficiently, but when we do try to tune it efficiently, is it any faster at computing things than cubicle type theory or not?
But isn't there another point which is important to me, is the subconceptual simplicity?
Yes.
So I find a cubicle, if you teach it to student and you have to explain them how to use this composition primitive, it's actually quite hard, and it's really, you can only understand it by understanding, well, we can really properly understand it by understanding the cubical model. Whereas I find in higher observational type theory, there's a more sort of conceptual way to explain these things. I mean, yeah, you can also use this cubical explanation, but you can also explain it in its own terms, so to say. Would you agree with this? Or?
Yes, I agree with that, definitely. And I hope that that's going to be helpful sort of pedagogically also, that it sort of provides maybe a bridge to formalization and to understanding higher homotopies and categories for students. I mean, this is one of the things, we have already observed this sort of thing in Bokhod already, that there are students who, people like me came from classical homotopy theory, and then we sort of import our intuitions from that and learn to do the same sorts of things in type theory. But then there are other people like Egbert who grew up with type theory, and sort of they learn homotopy theory by doing type theory. And sort of they end up with really, with different intuitions, and they sort of are able to think of ways of doing things that never would have occurred to us. And I think over time, maybe this myth may sort of transform mathematics more noticeably in the pedagogical way.
Yeah.
So I normally just ask whether there's anything else you would love to share, but maybe Torsten has a more specific question first.
No, that's fine. I mean,
then, because we are already at 1 hour, and this is our new target time. So, but if you have something you would like to share, some advertisement, whatever, we have time for that, of course.
I think I said everything I wanted to say.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It was fun.
Yeah, thank you.
I learned a lot, and I will look into that proof assistant. I haven't done so, but I will give my humble feedback as what an total outsider can make out of it.
Maybe one thing to say to people who are looking into Narya, it's experimental in a lot of ways, and that means that a lot of things are going to change, and that also means that it's very open to feedback. So in particular, like, I don't know. I feel like maybe I'm an outlier here, but I liked talking about syntax. I sort of made various choices in designing the syntax of Narya, which are a little bit different than other proof assistants. And I really want to know what people think about them, but hardly anybody seems to want to think about syntax. Any sort of feedback at all, please let me know, or put comments on GitHub issues, or there's a channel on the Homotopy Type Theory Zulip server for questions and comments and thoughts about Narya. I'm happy to hear anything that people think about it.
Great. Then let me say once again, thank you very much for being here. And to the audience, thank you for listening, and feel free to comment.
Yeah.
And we will try to reply to every single comment. So far we can do that. Let's see, we are in a year. Maybe today we will overlook some comments, but for now, I think it's quite a nice discussion forum. Great. So thank you again, Mike.
You're welcome.
And have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.